know to share precise details about upcoming airstrike on Yemen. Can you provide us with more details about this?
Yes, I can. Compounding Pete Hegseth's bad week, a report by Pentagon's Inspector General has concluded that he violated Pentagon policies by using the Signal messaging app to share precise details about upcoming airstrikes in Yemen, including the quantity and airstrike times of manned U.S. aircraft over hostile territory approximately 2 to 4 hours before the missions were executed on 15th of March this year. The report by Pentagon's Inspector General determined that Hegseth's actions created a risk to operational security that could have resulted in failed U.S. mission objectives and potential harm to U.S. pilots. The information, which was marked as secret and not to be shared with foreign nationals, was transmitted via Pete Hegseth's unclassified personal device in group chats with other Trump administration officials. The investigation also found that Hegseth failed to retain all associated messages, violating federal record-keeping requirements.
I see.
Now, Senator Jack Reed, the top Democrat on the Armed Services Committee, said the report made clear that Secretary Hegseth violated Department of Defense policies and shared information that was classified at the time it was sent to him.
Right.
These were precise strike timings and locations that, had they fallen into enemy hands, could have enabled the Houthis in Yemen to target American pilots. So Senator Roger Wicker, a Republican chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, has actually defended Pete Hegseth's actions, saying that Hegseth was within his authority to do what he did. But he's the only one who's actually defended Hegseth. All the other senators have attacked Hegseth and described him as incompetent and putting U.S. service members' lives at risk, U.S. pilots' lives at risk, precisely because of what he did.
Listening to the Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran, English Radio. This program entitled, That Was the Week That Was. Some Republicans have also expressed their own concerns about Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth. Tell us more about that.
Yes, the vast majority of senators who have criticized Pete Hegseth have been Democratic senators, but a number of Republicans have also expressed their own concerns about the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth. Senator Rand Paul, a Republican senator, suggested that Hegseth had lied about the September boat attack, saying the Defense Secretary either was lying to us or he's incompetent and didn't know it had happened. Republican Congressman Don Bacon told CNN he had seen enough to conclude that Pete Hegseth was not the right leader for the Pentagon.
Right.
Pete Hegseth's tenure has also been marked by severe dysfunction inside the Pentagon itself, where his own aides earlier this year have been leaking against one another and informing on colleagues in what multiple officials described as a paranoid and chaotic atmosphere inside the Pentagon. The Defense Secretary used a leaked investigation, which the White House had reportedly lost confidence in, to purge three top advisors in the spring, with claims that they were identified through what would amount to an illegal, warrantless National Security Agency wiretap. The episode again raised fresh questions about Pete Hegseth's judgment and his ability to manage the Pentagon.
Right. Will Pete Hegseth be forced to resign as a Pentagon chief?
Well, that's a very good question. And the short answer to that is, it is unlikely that he'll be forced to resign. It is unlikely that he will be forced to resign. Because despite the twin controversies, you know, the controversy over the second attack on the boat, the two people clinging onto the wreckage being killed in the second direct attack on that boat, and the report by Pentagon's Inspector General, which revealed that Pete Hegseth has revealed classified information on a messaging app. So despite those two twin controversies creating what lawmakers have described as an untenable situation for Pete Hegseth, the war secretary, Donald Trump has continued to back Pete Hegseth publicly, with the White House expressing the utmost confidence in its national security team.
Yeah.
Now, since the Senate is controlled by Republicans and Donald Trump is maintaining his support of Pete Hegseth, Hegseth is unlikely to face any meaningful consequences, meaning that he's unlikely to be forced to tender his resignation.
Yeah, right, I see. To sum up very briefly then, there are calls by both Democratic and Republican senators for Pete Hegseth to resign as war secretary. Lawmakers have expressed concerns about Hegseth's tendency to push the blame onto his subordinates. However, Donald Trump's support for Hegseth means that he will probably survive as war secretary. Thank you, Mr. Dachshund, for your insightful analysis.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
For more on these and other critical issues, be sure to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Join us again next time for another edition of That Was the Week That Was. Take care and goodbye.
The seven skies, see a pure heart never lies. The words you learn will never earn. It's time to think and wonder why. Stars above will always be a shining guide for us to see. And when I doubt, I'll have no doubt, but still I wonder why. Digging through our pages past, wondering how the truth will last. God's in control is what I found. I think I'll try this time around. And no one really feels the path I seek. And no one's gonna care as much as me. We got
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRAB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. This is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be here with you guys. And welcome to today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. Well, so just like always, we have two very dear guests, and I enjoy their company. So just like always, you have to give us a very brief introduction about yourself. Therefore, Assalamu alaikum and welcome. Let's start with ladies. Sister Zainab.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having me. I am Zainab and glad to be here. I am student of linguistics and at the same time have an exposure in the halls of studies.
Thank you very much for coming here. And you, Brother Muhammad, assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam. It's a pleasure to be here with you again. My name is Muhammad. I'm a Quran student and a Quran teacher, and I've studied English literature, but mostly I'm interested in Quranic studies.
Let's get directly into the very heart of discussion, which is, do we care to be understood by people or not?
Well, I think both yes and no to this question. Sometimes we should care. That do people understand us or not? I think most of the times.
Mm-hmm.
And it really less number of situations that we don't care. Even Quran teaches us, Prophet Musa asks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, oh my Lord, expand for me my chest and ease my task for me and remove the impediment of my tongue so that they may understand what I say. So Quran is teaching us that, you know, Prophet Musa is making dua. These scholars ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that they give them the capability to talk in a way that people understand. And I think as a linguistic, we have always known this thing that whenever we talk, our aim is that people understand us.
Yeah.
So it is our concern that people understand us.
But then we'll get back to that because words are not the best conduits to create understanding.
Not
I guess
always.
Sometimes they are more prone to misunderstanding than to understanding. Okay, brother, what is men's view on this? Do they care about being understood or not?
First of all, what you mean by understand is actually a little different. It's not the literal meaning of understanding as in, you know, I'm saying something and you know what I'm saying. You know the meaning of my words. That's not what we actually mean by do you understand me? Like when we say, is it important if people understand you or not? Is that do they appreciate you? Do they feel that like what you are saying, your feelings are important to them or not? This is the meaning of understand.
Exactly, here. Yeah.
Having that empathy, okay? So is it important that people understand me? For example, I'm a person who has studied a lot. I have studied for many years in the university and I have gained a lot of knowledge. And I expect society to understand me. What does that mean? That means that I want people to appreciate me, to make use of my knowledge. Like we say, we have to be like a sounding board. Is this good or is this necessary or not? Okay, it is necessary. It's definitely necessary. And I believe that for the mental and psychological health of a society, every single individual of a society should be understood.
Yeah, but
by others.
Should be.
Okay. But sometimes
far away from reality.
Now, it's not going to happen all the time. That's problematic. And what we have to do here is that, in my opinion, one of the things we have to do is that we have to seek counsel if we feel that we're not being understood, because this could be very destructive.
Mm-hmm.
If you are living in a world where you feel that you are not being appreciated, that you're not being understood, and you're like, what's the use of my life then if no one understands me? So such people, first, they should seek counsel.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that they have to go to a counselor necessarily. They can seek the counsel of the, you know, like their parents, teachers.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Words are the strangest invention of human beings, and yes, they do help, but most of the times they're not the best way possible to let us convey what we want to do convey. So welcome back. This is Back to Reality, and we are talking about something which is very common, and that is, do we really care about being understood by others or not? Well, the answer obviously is yes, we do care, but does it happen? Is it my responsibility to always explain myself to others?
You see, making yourself understood to others, it's not your duty, okay? It's like if people can't understand you for whatever reason, it's not your duty to, you know, try to force them to understand you, okay?
But I'm living with them, actually.
In some situations, we just have to let it go. We can't do anything. If people don't understand you, then there's nothing you can do sometimes.
You know, I think there is this, you also have to look at how much effort you have done yourself. If mm-hmm. there's something lacking on your side, you have to work on that. For example, I'll tell you, I have been writing a book like for more than 3 years now, but I have not published it yet. For example, I showed it first, like, I finished it like maybe 1.5 years ago, and I first showed it to my uncle. And the moment he read it, he said, maybe your vocab is good. Maybe you know very good number of words and all. But the normal people don't know that. When you're writing something, when you're conveying something, do care about the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes, like as Brother Olds already said earlier, he said that I have went to so many universities, I studied here, there, and I... You know, worked hard. And
I expect.
Yeah. No, it's like, for example, you studied well, you had exposure to those universities, but not the audience that now you are, addressing.
Dealing
to.
With, yeah.
They have the same exposure. So sometimes you have to level yourself down for the public, for the audience, but you have to make sure that the thing that I want to convey, I will convey it in the best possible
way. So there are ways to make myself understandable.
Like if you tell me I literally hate the new linguistic technique of Gen Z, I hate the phrases they use. They use something that is limited to them. They use something that only they understand and we don't understand, or be like, I don't know about the rest of the world. But there is something like now we have Gen Z and it sounds cool and this means this. Like, I dealt with these people, and I said, like, why were you so rude? And they were like, no, this is not rude. We are, like, meant to be sarcastic. Who does teach you that? Where
does
that
come
from?
This is the essence of their generation.
Yeah, so it's basically, you don't, sometimes you care,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes you don't care, but you're just using what you know. But
yeah.
I have to use the techniques to convey properly. I have to make all the efforts.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm making all the efforts and then still someone does not want to understand me, like brother said that you also need empathy from the society and someone is not giving you that, I think at that place you should let it go, as he said.
I think she made a really good point about how we also have to make the effort to try to level ourselves with our audience and not expect everyone to understand exactly what everything that we say, because probably our level is too high, and you know, we have to try to adapt to our audiences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this is the point. It's like even right now, like even though I know a lot of things, maybe a lot of people don't know those things, but I have to try to keep the level at a level that is enough for my audience, for the listeners to understand me.
You have. Okay. You also have
we
to
have
be
no
empathetic.
Choice.
As a speaker,
we have to be like that.
As a speaker,
okay.
You
and
also,
also
have to be
we
empathetic.
Should not be selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we should not be like, why should I do everything? People have to serve me. They have to do things for me. It shouldn't be like that. We also have to make the effort. We have to go and actually try to make people understand us in a way that is, you know, like, I would say healthy for ourselves.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, psychologically healthy.
Yeah, speaking
healthy.
Of psychology, I just remembered something. Why do people care for being understood? Like, is it the matter of validation from others? Or
why should they not care, actually?
You
so
see, I'm saying that
it's
if
not
I
about,
forget
it's
about
not
this
about
fact.
It's not about validation. It's about what is the aim of your speech.
Mm-hmm.
What is the, why are you talking even? What is the aim of your speech? You are talking to get understood, to be understood by people,
to convey
right?
a meaning, technically.
Right?
That's what I...
But sometimes, like, you know, you're dealing with people who will misunderstand
mm-hmm.
you, definitely. You're dealing with people who deliberately, who do understand you, but still they are misusing your words and
yeah.
spreading rumors and, you know, doing the stuff.
Having
in
their own
case,
interpretations.
In that case also, Islam has taught us to be moderate, to be balanced, like... One prophet, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, he tried his level best. He even went beyond. Then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala stops him. Stop. Are you going to, like, kill yourself with this?
لَقَدْ جَاءَكُمْ رَسُولٌ مِّنْ أَنفُسِكُمْ عَزِيزٌ عَلَيْهِ مَا عَنِتُّمْ حَرِيصٌ عَلَيْكُمْ. He was greedy in guiding people.
In his efforts.
In his efforts to guide people.
Yeah.
He would kill himself to make sure that everyone would be guided because he was so compassionate.
Yeah.
He was so
he
kind.
Cared for every single
he was
individual.
So generous, yeah.
Yeah.
So here also again, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala guides us that we
mm-hmm.
have to be moderate. We don't have to kill ourselves with the fact that, okay, they should understand me anyhow. I have to do, we have to do efforts. We have to try
yeah.
our best. But we don't have to, like, you know, as Islam guides us, to be on a moderate way.
Be moderate. And sometimes, by the way, I have a personal question. How many times have you seen yourself in such a condition that you have to explain yourself and you saw any success in that? Do you think explanation is going to do any help?
Not everywhere. Not everywhere. That's why I said that sometimes you have to level down yourself. Sometimes you have to take into consideration and you have to empathetic with your audience. Okay, maybe I had this exposure. Maybe I know this. Maybe they don't know this. So that time when you're being empathetic, you're putting yourself into their shoes and you're leveling yourself down and you're trying to make them understand their way. Yes. But no, sometimes we have also met negative people who don't want to understand,
yeah.
who do take,
this
who
is
understand
the point.
Properly,
yeah.
but they don't want to take it. They don't
that's
want to be empathetic with you. Right?
Yeah, that's very true.
So that's different. So mm-hmm. I have, yeah, personally, I have dealt with both kind of people.
Yeah, what about you, brother?
Definitely, absolutely. I have so many times been in a condition where I say certain things, but the people I'm talking to, they just don't understand me no matter what. And it's really annoying, you know? It's like,
very.
It is
you say
annoying,
something,
and that's why I think, you know.
And it's not just a matter of, like, understanding what I say literally. It's something deeper, you know? It's like, I'm trying to say something that's really deep, and they take it too literally. And this is where it gets really problematic, and it really, really annoys me.
I think you should, take guidance from the same words, like, you know, when Prophet Musa says, expand my chest, kind of, you know.
Exactly.
Give me patience,
yeah.
because it is
yeah,
annoying.
It is.
Yeah.
Like in Arabic, we say, sa'atu sabr. Yeah, I really need to take my chest to be
expanded.
I need my chest to be
yeah.
expanded a lot. So.
To have to
but yeah, but
patience.
It's a very common scenario where you have when you believe in certain things,
mm-hmm.
when you say certain things and people, they say, man, you're crazy. You don't know what you're saying.
Yeah.
I have had that a lot.
Exactly.
And many times I just have to just remain silent.
Yeah.
I'll just say, okay, I'm not going to say anything then. Because if I say something, you're going to be like, oh, why, what are you saying?
It's adding too much more to that craziness.
You're out
of
your mind. I'm like, okay, then. Fine, then. I'm not going to say anything.
Yeah. Yes, to be understood is a privilege, I guess. It's something that if it happens, it's even beyond having a virtue, having something like a blessing by your side. But if it does not happen, that's, I guess, not the end of the world. Half of the world suffer from the same thing. So you're not alone. This is all for today. I hope you have just enjoyed that. Until another episode of Back to Reality. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabbal Alameen, Ya Rahmanu, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabbal Alameen, Ya Rahmanu, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again. Once again,
the bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim walhamdu wath-thana' lillahi rabbil alamin was-salatu was-salam ala ashrafil anbiya'i wal mursalin habibi qulubina wa tabibi nufusina abil qasim al mustafa Muhammad wa ala ali baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaykum. This is a great pleasure, a great blessing in my life to be spending a few minutes of our day on the great legacy of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, letters that he has written to the Almighty Lord in the language of supplication, letters that reading those letters teaches us life lessons that can improve the quality of our lives. I would call it life coaching, right? The 20th dua, the 20th supplication of Sahifa Sajjadiyah is under the title, or is under the title of noble, asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, supplicating to the Almighty on noble moral traits and acts pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Fi وكان من دعائه عليه السلام في مكارم الأخلاق ومرضي الأفعال. The dua starts, the supplication starts with this: Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. O Allah, bless Muhammad and his household. Wa balligh bi imani akmal al iman. Cause my faith to reach the most perfect faith. Waj'al yaqini afdal al yaqin. Make my certainty, my conviction, my yaqeen to become the most excellent one, right? To get leveled up to get upgraded to the most excellent one. And we talked about signs of certainty in the previous session. In this session, I'm going to continue to talk about the signs of certainty in the ahadith and in the words and in the kalam of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, only after a quick break. Stay tuned with us.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Respected brothers and sisters, Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, in a beautiful hadith says, يُسْتَدَلُّ عَلَى الْيَقِينِ بِقَسْرِ الْأَمَلِ وَإِخْلَاسِ الْعَمَلِ وَالزُّهْدِ فِي الدُّنْيَا. Certainty in the heart, in reality, in its core, is inferred by three things. Number one, the shortening of worldly wishes, right? Amal. And here, amal is worldly wishes. Oh, I'm dreaming and craving so much for having a mansion in this dunya, right? This is not a sign of mu'min. A mu'min always strives to increase the quality of the life in this dunya and the hereafter. Does not choose to be poor, right? Does not excuse his laziness with zuhd and abstention, right? This is absolutely a misunderstanding of the concept of zuhd. This is a misunderstanding of what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has wanted from us. You have to strive to increase and promote the quality of your worldly and your hereafter life, right? Both of them at the same time. In fact, you have to focus more on increasing and improving the quality of your residence and dwelling and a stay in the hereafter, which takes a lot of work. But at the same time, that doesn't mean you have to forget about this dunya, right? Imam says one of the signs of a believer is that they have the shortening of worldly desires and wishes, right? It's short. Like, what do you want from this dunya? It's a small, tiny bits of cravings for this dunya. I just want a beautiful house. I just want somewhere that is a shelter for me and my family. We can live a comparably, like, relatively comfortable life. That's about it, right? I'm not after a luxury life, super duper luxury life, right? This is what I want from this dunya. What's your dream? They would never say this, a huge list of wishes and dreams that would never end, right? The second one is wa ikhlas al amal, right? Sincerity of actions, regardless of people giving them applause and encouraging them, or people denouncing them and discouraging them and tearing apart their reputations, they would still do the same thing because of the pleasure, because of the pleasing of the Lord the Almighty. That is what ikhlas is. Sincerity of intentions is sincerity in performing actions. Ikhlas al amal. And the third one is the asceticism, the abstention, the zuhd towards the world, right? This is inconsistent with one's hereafter, with what that is in contradiction with the hereafter. They would have the ability. Zuhd is what, that's how we define zuhd. Zuhd is the ability to be able to prefer akhirah, prefer the hereafter, prefer the eternity over the transient temporary life of this dunya. Let's take another break. Inshallah, we'll be back quickly.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio.
All right, another beautiful hadith from our beloved Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. He says, another sign of a person who has certainty, who has yaqeen, is this: man yastayghin ya'mal jahidan. The one who has yaqeen, the one who has certainty, does what? His actions show it because he works diligently. He works with the full capacity. He works striving with all of his capacity, 100% of his abilities at work. That's the sign of a person who has yaqeen. When you look at the life of the martyrs, right, the lives of these shuhada, especially the recent ones, you see 60 years, 70 years of non-stop work, non-stop sacrifice, non-stop service. The third, another hadith, again from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. He says, what is patience? Defining patience, he says, as-sabru thamaratu al-yaqeen, right? Patience, as-sabr, in tribulations, in difficulties, in moments of obedience, is the fruit of yaqeen, is the fruit of certainty. You have an image of the eternity in your head and you believe in it, then that gives you patience in the ups and downs and difficulties of this dunya. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را، هرگز مخواه از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را. Save the palace.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight on Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Israeli genocide on Gaza continues, along with its frequent attacks on Lebanon, killing more civilians. Meanwhile, the U.S. government has released a document regarding its national security strategy. It says that conflict and violence in the Middle East are subsiding since the ceasefire in Gaza and the U.S.'s attack on Iran. Now, the Trump administration says it will now concentrate on the Western Hemisphere and regional dominance. This is Trump says the U.S. will re-implement the Monroe Doctrine. Well, what is going on in Trumpville, and where is it all headed, and what does it mean for Latin America and beyond? Stay with us as we take a look at the latest on the Spotlight. Let's begin with this report.
The Trump administration has released its national security strategy for 2025, a document that marks stark differences from earlier strategies issued by the same administration. Let's go over some of the key details.
Western hemispheric dominance, aiming to block what it calls foreign influence in the Americas and shift U.S. military assets toward the Western Hemisphere, away from theaters whose relative importance to American national security has declined in recent decades.
The strategy outlines a major shift in U.S. military posture. Observers say the move may be linked to recent U.S. strikes on boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific, and efforts to remove Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro by force.
Deterring conflict over Taiwan, unlike earlier strategies that framed China as the top geopolitical rival, the 2025 NSS declares that economic relations are the decisive arena. It underscores the need for allies, particularly India, to increase defense spending to help balance China's growing power in the Indo-Pacific.
The document signals a change in tone. Rather than framing China solely as a geopolitical rival, it emphasizes economic competition as the decisive arena. At the same time, it calls on allies, particularly India, to increase defense spending to help balance China's growing influence in the Indo-Pacific.
Berating Europe, criticizing Europe's migration policies, regulatory focus, and handling of Ukraine conflict, suggesting that the continent must take primary responsibility for its own defense. Switching focus from the West Asia, declaring the region no longer a top priority due to U.S. energy independence and perceived decline in conflict, though still committed to Israel's security. It goes on to argue that the conflict and violence in the region are also subsiding, citing the ceasefire in Gaza and the U.S. attack on Iran in June, which it said significantly degraded Tehran's nuclear program.
It declares the United States energy independent, a claim critics say underscores whether Washington's past involvement in the region was driven by oil. Yet critics point out that Israeli violations of the Gaza ceasefire continue, and Iran remains determined to pursue its peaceful nuclear program. Upon a question about Gaza ceasefire's phase two, Trump told reporters on Thursday that it was going along well. He acknowledged Palestinian deaths as a problem, yet he insisted that West Asia is at peace.
We have peace in the Middle East. People don't realize it. We have tremendous support. 59 countries. There's tremendous support.
Tehran has dismissed the strategy as essentially a security document for Israel. Iran argues that ensuring U.S. access to regional energy resources and guaranteeing Israel's security are the two fundamental issues driving Washington's policy in West Asia. Critics say the new national security strategy only underscores the hypocrisy of the Trump administration, revealing that America's true aim has always been dominating global energy and expanding Israel's power at any cost.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Joe Immisberger, writer and political commentator out of Windsor, Canada. And Mike Billington, author and commentator out of Leesburg, out of the U.S. Thank you both for being with me. Start this off in Canada. And Joe, well, let's look at some of the issues highlighted in this document. But first, let me ask you, why now? Why is the U.S. saying that the Western Hemisphere will be its priority and the Middle East or West Asia is actually calming?
Well, it's obviously untrue that it's calming. I mean, the genocide in Gaza continues, and the United States has already forced through a resolution, the UN resolution, making itself the colonial governor of Gaza, of the Palestinian territories, on behalf of Israel. So it's patently untrue that anything's calming. It's just as long as Palestinians are dying at a level that isn't gaining too much attention in media, and as long as Israelis are not dying at a rate that's noticeable in the media, then they consider it to be a calm. So it's obviously untrue. When you look at documents like this, there's always a tremendous amount of dishonesty in this. So you always have to distinguish between what's real and what's. But the document, to me, I read through it, and it's a typical U.S. Declaration that it rules, that it's the dictator of the entire Western Hemisphere, and that it's going to be determined to be the dictator, basically. So I think some of this shift from West Asia stuff is just appealing to its base that's sick of the so-called forever wars. I mean, they even use that term, forever wars, in the document. So there's this need to kind of package their foreign policy to their base as something different that's not going to entangle the United States in wars. But when you're seeking to be the world's supremacist state that tells everybody what to do, including your so-called allies in Europe, then of course you're going to a war.
Okay. Well, Mike, I mean, the document says its goal is America first. Of course, that was Trump's main thing running for presidency. I mean, with that in mind, why do we not see a change in Washington's support for the Israeli regime, even with this new document?
Well, with the Israeli machine, the so-called Zionist lobby, this is a deeply ingrained force within the United States, and Trump does respond to that force. He's part of it, in a sense. So that's not surprising. I would emphasize, however, that the big problem, let me say two things. One is that there are very good aspects to this document.
Let me
come back to that. The biggest problem with it is this idea that we can take over the Western Hemisphere, and this, of course, is at a moment where the Trump administration, under people like Marco Rubio, we call him Narco Rubio, and Hegseth, are planning to unleash a new war, exactly what Trump swore he would not do during his election campaign and since. But they're about to start a war that would not only be Venezuela, but probably all of Ibero-America. And the real intent here has absolutely nothing to do with drugs, which they claim this is stopping drug trade. But in fact, Venezuela's drug trade is minimal compared to Colombia and other places. But the purpose is to prevent especially China, but also Russia, from having any role whatsoever in South America. This is what terrifies the financial institutions in London and Washington and New York, which is that the ability to control and loot the raw materials in places like South America, but also Africa and elsewhere, because they're turning to the Belt and Road and to the Chinese for real development rather than just financing and then looting. But let me say that there are very, very positive aspects. And you asked what? Well, it's I'm going to read you a quote from a former CIA analyst, Larry Johnson, who has become a leading spokesman against the war policy in the U.S. By both the Biden and earlier administrations, and unfortunately, as Trump is not completely separate from, despite his very honorable effort to reestablish relations with Russia, and the work that took place over these last week or so with Wycliffe on his talks with Putin and Ushakov, represent a very positive and potentially resolutionary state of this. And let me read what Larry Johnson said, because he also makes the same mistake on the question of South America, but he says otherwise that this document, marks a potentially profound shift in U.S. foreign policy under President Donald Reagan's second administration, rejecting global hegemony and ideological crusades in favor of pragmatic, transactional realism focused on protecting core national interests, homeland security, and economic prosperity, and regional dominance of the Western Hemisphere. So he capitulates on this so-called dominance of the Western Hemisphere, which, of course, with Rubio and the Trump administration criminally bombing boats for which they have no evidence there's any crimes being carried out. They just claim these are drug boats, but even if they are, they're not in a position to reach the United States. It's a fake. It's like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It's a fake excuse for a policy which is very, very dangerous.
Okay, stay with me. Sorry to interrupt you, Mike, but let me get Joe back in on this conversation. I mean, Joe, you heard what Mike had said about the positive side of this. On the one hand, though, Mike said that, unfortunately, what they're looking at in Latin America and now what they're doing to the fishermen or whatever, this isn't new, though. The policy of the United States, as he also was talking about the WMDs in Iraq, there's always been some type of excuse. But what it seems this document basically also is saying that they're not going to even use the spread of democracy excuse anymore. Because in the document, basically, it's saying that, you know what, people have different ways of running their systems, and basically we're not even worried about that anymore. So there is definitely fundamental change in what is happening. What do you attribute this to, Joe?
Well, the United States has been in relative decline ever since the end of World War II. So to some extent, they have to acknowledge reality. For example, the last, Trump's segment of the Republican Party, sure, they're less hawkish towards Russia because they aren't comfortable with the idea of taking on Russia and China at the same time. That's actually stupid from an imperial point of view. So they can look more somewhat more rational in a way when they talk about Russia than the Democrats, who are just gung-ho about confronting Russia and China at the same time. So there's kind of an acknowledgement of reality that you're in relative decline and that you have to pick your fights and prioritize. But that's always the case with an empire. But the problem is that when you're an empire, when you're seeking the kind of even regional dominance that they claim they're seeking, it's a global dominance that they're after. But to even do that, they cannot never let any piece of it break away. I mean, that's why Trump's blatantly interfering in the election in Honduras. I mean, these Honduras, unlike Venezuela, doesn't claim to have the world's largest oil reserves or anything, but they can't help but interfere in small countries like Cuba, like even Haiti. They can't let any little piece of the world get away without them being involved and trying to steer it in their direction and undermine its sovereignty. So it's, I think, regardless of even if they sincerely wanted to try to pick their battles, but when you're aspiring to be to dominate the world, then you're going to end up getting intervening everywhere because you just can't afford to let anything slip out of your grasp. So I think this is just a difference in the way different factions of the U.S. ruling elite, the way they market themselves. Trump doesn't want to, his base doesn't like things like democracy and pretending that they're going to overthrow Maduro out of some benevolent or altruistic desire to free Venezuelans. They prefer to concoct an excuse that we're defending ourselves. So it's a difference in marketing, but the overall global imperial strategy is the same.
All right. Well, Mike, now the U.S. claims that the situation is calming in the Middle East or Western Asia, but in reality, with Washington's continued support of the Zionist regime, the genocide has not ended in Gaza, and the regime continues to kill people in the West Bank and in Lebanon. The U.S. lights the flame and then says it has stepped out of the fire. I mean, what are your thoughts overall about this? Is this just the U.S. knowing that it has failed in West Asia and is trying to find an escape, or how do you see it?
I think both what you and your friend from Canada said is giving into an extremely simplistic view of the world situation as a whole right now. And I don't disagree with what you're saying and what both of you are saying about what's happening in the Middle East and in South America. But the crucial thing taking place in the world right now is that the potential of a global nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia, or Russia and China, is being given an alternative approach by what Trump is doing in the total opposite approach of what we've had in previous governments, to try to bring about some cooperation with Russia, and the Russians are very open to this. And he's now going to go meet with Xi Jinping in China. So the potential of having a similar positive relationship with China is also on the table. And nothing can be more important in a world facing economic disintegration and the potential of nuclear war than these three major powers coming together. If we can bring about a sane approach in the U.S. to working with the BRICS countries, working with Russia and with China and the other global South countries, this would be a potential dramatic shift in history. The ending of the colonial era and the unleashing of what could and must be what the LaRouche movement has always fought for, a new architecture based on security and development for every country on Earth. Now, obviously, that doesn't cohere with launching a new insane war in South America, or the continuation of the battle in Gaza and in the Palestinian area.
Okay, let me just jump in here, because isn't that where the problem lies? Understand what you're saying, Mike, as far as perhaps intention in some cases with the U.S. government. But Joe, when we look at the reality that's happening, at the end of the day, the United States is basically the military-industrial complex runs the show, and are they ready to actually give up this hegemonic perspective in creating chaos in order to work together? Yes, we all know that it's better to work together, but that has never been the intent of imperialist entities. I mean, how do you see it?
Well, first of all, the domination of the Western Hemisphere, that makes sense. If you want to confront China and Russia down the road more effectively, you want to secure greater control of the countries closer to you. So what I see this is to some extent, some maneuvering to maybe try to get Russia and China basically to sell out South America, Central and South America, and just say, okay, this is our turf. We'll stay out of it, and we'll give you some concessions on other things. So I see that. Ultimately as a very sinister maneuver that I don't think is going to prevent the United States from confronting Russia and China, because the very nature of the United States, and you can see it all over this document, is to become the global, become what even more of what it already is—a global empire, a bully that just tells everybody else, including even the